I wanted to dispel even a tiny bit of it. I wanted to say, before the thought even formed, "Peace be upon you. I am here. You are here. We are only passing one another in the street." Sometimes my daughters would look down on me if, after an upsetting interaction, they insisted we had been wronged, and they would turn on me instead, tell me that I had given in, I had been weak, I had not fought to be respected. But I did fight. I tried to leave every human I have interacted with better than or the same as when I encountered them. I have gone out of my way to apologize to a stranger I might brush against in passing, or have held the door open for a family entering the restaurant after mine. These are small things, I know. Sometimes even I frustrated myself. Why should I always have to put forth this demeanor? Why could I not be bumped by the man in the cafe and not be the one who apologized first and always? Sometimes men bumped me and they said nothing, even as I turned my head to call after them. But on most days it was not like this. It was the way I wanted to move through the world. I had a beard, a modest one. I had my face. I had my name with a hard ending. That was my fight, to continue to do little things for people around me, so no one would find fault in my demeanor and misattribute it to my religion. One evening, I returned home from another business trip and parked my car in the driveway. My house, the magnolia tree, the patch of grass and the basketball hoop above the garage door, all of it was familiar to me. And yet, I felt like a stranger. The key to the front door was in my hand, but I hesitated before announcing my arrival. I had gone away for work trips for so long and so often that I feared my absence was as unnoticed as my presence, or worse. All this work done to provide for a family that could go on effortlessly without me. I walked to the wooden gate at the side of the house. If I stood on tiptoe and felt around the other side, I could unlock the hook and allow myself into the backyard. The green hose was curled in one corner and looked blue in the dark. There were fresh footsteps and a cigarette butt in the dirt beside it. You had not thought to press it down or flick it over the fence. By then you were 16, and there was little you cared to do for our sake. My next trip would not be for months, but I wondered if I should request another sooner. I imagined that you were relieved whenever I left, because there would be no one to reprimand you or interrogate you about how your studies were going, or to ask the reason for your departure. Whose home are you going to? What for? The wind blew. I shivered. It had rained hours before. The air was still misty. Little drops gathered on the waxy surface of dark leaves, reflecting light. I walked until I reached our plum tree and leaned against it. My home was framed in my view. On the second floor, the light of my bedroom was off, but Huda's adjacent to it was on. Her curtains were partly drawn. Lace, she wanted then. A cream lace and pale mint walls. And I had gone to the store wondering how I could have one child that wanted curtains with lace accents and another child who had punched holes into our walls and tried to cover them with posters, had kicked his lamp so that it was permanently bent and imbalanced, had begun to smoke, did not even have the decency to step away from our premises to do so. Your mother's face appeared in the kitchen window. She turned on the tap and began to wash something in the sink. Surely she could not see me. The window she looked out from would only show her own face, the glass a sheet of black. She turned around and then back to the window. a slight smile on her lips. She began talking, her face moving from expression to expression, and I saw it was you behind her. You were wearing that hat of yours I despised, worn backward and askew in a way that frustrated me. How even your dressing evoked attitude and arrogance. You began washing whatever it was that had been in her hands. You were good in that way. You always offered to help her. Even I did not do that then. Layla disappeared and then reappeared in the dining room area, her whole body visible through the sliding glass door. And she walked almost on tiptoe, the base of her ankle a fraction above the tile, and she turned the light above the table as bright as it could go, so that it splayed onto the concrete just outside. I am still in darkness, I thought. So far back that she would have to really be looking, would have to press her face against the glass and block out the world around her with her palms. And even then, she might miss me. Something shifted in my sight. I glanced up to the second floor and saw Huda's light had been turned off. So the whole of upstairs was dark, and I thought, well, good. They turn the lights off when I am not home, as I tell them to. You must have said something to your mother, because she leaned against the table and laughed. She looked so at ease. She lifted her hand up to cup her mouth, the way our daughters laugh timidly and yet loudly. You were good in that way, too, making anyone around you laugh. I could never quite figure out how you did it. You splashed the drops of water into the sink, wiped your hands on your clean shirt. You disappeared. You reappeared. You and your mother placed plates and bowls of steaming food onto the table. All the while your lips moved, your expressions changed. Whatever you spoke about engaged you both. And I thought of how I know only silence. Huda appeared and took a seat at the dinner table, her head bent over the phone in her hand. And I saw you try to read over her shoulder, the exaggerated expression on your face, so I knew you only wanted to tease her with the illusion of interest, or you wanted to make Layla smile. Huda swatted you away, her hair flipping around her when she twisted her neck to glare at you after she caught you. Up close, these things bothered me. But from out here, it wasn't so bad. It was all done in play. Huda must have complained to Layla then, because Layla shrugged, that smile still on her face that I feared would fall if I entered. My family seemed complete, save for Hadia, who was in undergrad by then and would not be back until the following weekend. The wind rustled the leaves in the trees, and the neighbor's dog, a few houses down, barked. I had never thought of leaving your mother. The thought of divorce never once crossed my mind. But that night, you sat in the seat that was my seat. This is how my home must be without me in it, I thought. And it looked just fine. Warm and bright, the three of you there, talking animatedly together. Huda had put her phone away. She tied her hair up and sat with one leg tucked beneath her. You helped spoon food onto her plate. Layla was still smiling a little. You took your hat off and hooked it on your knee. And that was when the thought first occurred to me, that I could go. I could leave. I could walk alongside the little tomatoes and mint leaves and step through the gate back into the driveway, the metal lock clicking shut behind me. Say I left that night. Would you have been able to stay then? After Abbas Ali passed away, I grew deeply worried for you. I had really liked that boy. He cared for you, and he looked out for you, and I trusted him. I was at peace any time the two of you were together. After his death, I began to fear that the little that connected you to our faith would be severed, and eventually I organized a trip for our family to do Ziyarat in Iraq. I wanted there to be nothing I did not introduce you to that could be a tool for you and your spirituality. When I first brought the trip up with you, you asked if you could stay back at home. But when you saw the look on my face, you quickly said you did not mean it. You would come. I could see how one might deny a night at mosque, but could not fathom turning down an invitation to go to the holiest of places. Once in Iraq, my girls wore black abayas over their clothes. They looked luminous and almost unrecognizable. Even you, who respected nothing, seemed in awe. That first day in Najaf, you walked wide-eyed through the streets. Men sold tea in the street from giant steaming vats. Piles of sugar heaped in bowls where flies buzzed. Wheelbarrows heaped with fruit. We were patted down at checkpoints every few miles. Children ran barefoot and asked us for sticks of gum and spare change, and you never mastered the art of saying no. You reached into your pocket for a bill, and by the time you had pulled it out, you were swarmed by other children. The markets and the hot sun and the dust and the flustering ends of the black abayas, and soon we looked up and could see the golden dome of Imam Ali's shrine, which stood brilliantly against the blue sky. Peace be upon you, Amir al-Mu'mineen, leader of the faithful, I whispered, and I looked to my right, and to my surprise, your lips were also moving. Once inside, the ladies had to go to one side and men another. There was nothing to do there but pray, in organized groups or alone, by reading prayer books or just by speaking openly from one's heart. You were in the notebook phase that I hoped every year would leave you. I did not like it. I did not hide my dislike. I did not want you, an already sensitive man, to dwell even more in your sensitivity and become further removed from pursuing a respectable, well-paying career. But there, I did not mind it. I read from my prayer books outside, while around me birds hopped from prayer mat to prayer mat, and next to me, you scribbled away. In a country where we knew neither the language nor the customs and could not spend the day with Layla and the girls, you and I had no choice but to be at ease with one another, even if it was in silence. When the rush surrounding the Sari of Imam Ali dulled, we could easily approach his shrine. It stood proud beneath a chandelier that threw lights on the decorated mirrors of the walls, and we could hold the rounded metal of the gate, close our eyes, and pray. I rested my forehead against the metal. It was cool. I prayed for the things I always prayed for, but there, in that place, so close to my Imam, whom I had spent my whole life hearing stories of and hoping to be like even in the smallest of ways, I felt even more strongly the possibility of being heard. I opened my eyes. You were still holding on to the Zari. I had never seen you afford that attention, your eyes closed and eyebrows knit together. What did you pray for? I asked later, when you took a seat beside me outside. You sat holding on to your knees. You were 18 then. You looked so handsome that day, and so much like my father, the tips of your hair beginning to curl slightly. That God will forgive Abbas's sins, you said. I nodded.
He will, I said.
You looked at me. Your face was sincere and full of concern, as if you were asking me, how did I know?
God is merciful. We must not forget it. Abbas was a wonderful person.
My answer did not comfort you. You watched a bird that had landed by our feet. You reached your hand into your pocket, and I predicted you would pull out a piece of that very thin bread we ate while there.
But he sinned, you said.
You did pull the bread from your pocket. The bird cocked its head to one side and then hopped closer. You tore the bread into tiny pieces and tossed them one at a time, like Layla chopping up the apples for the horses. If we, just humans and entirely limited in our thinking, could think to break resources into smaller pieces so our children could feel the joy of scattering slices a little longer, then what generosity was our Creator not capable of?
Amar, God is so merciful that on Judgment Day He will forgive so many souls that even Shaitan will have hope for his own salvation.
That's sweet, you said. You gestured all done to the bird, but the bird did not go. I lightly hit my own cheek to say Tawbah.
Only you would find the devil sweet.
You smiled and glanced at me from the corner of your eye.
I chuckled. We were getting along.
Perhaps in wanting to impart fear of God and therefore adherence to His laws, I had not done enough to show you the side of God who was, above all, merciful.
Did you have a nice time?
Layla asked when we found her at the appointed meeting spot.
We did, you answered before I could.
You turned to watch boys in the street playing soccer. They were barefoot and most of them were children. Layla and Hadia wanted to search the markets for achik rings, and Huda wanted an achik necklace.
Can I join them instead?
You asked me and gestured to the group.
They had made goalposts out of piles of bricks. One boy jumped to knock the soccer ball with his head into the goal, and they cheered.
You had asked me. You had cared about how your actions would affect me.
Yes, I said.
Go. And I squinted as you stepped, it seemed, toward the sun.
At a wedding many years ago, you told me you were going to say hello to the younger Ali boys, Kumail and Saif. At this time, Abbas had recently passed away. I made small talk with the person seated next to me and eventually realized that a long time had passed and you still had not returned, and the Ali boys had taken seats by their father. I was suspicious and slightly worried, and I excused myself and went looking for you. You were not in the parking lot. You were not in the bathroom. And then, as I took a glass of mango juice from the drinks tray and scanned the hall while sipping it, the elevator door that led to the rest of the hotel opened, and out stepped Amara Ali. She was smiling to herself as if she alone had discovered the secret of the universe. She looked quite beautiful, possessing not only the beauty all women do in their youth, but also something indefinable, a poise that was not yet elegance, but the promise of it. She walked quickly, and it occurred to me that none of the wedding guests had any business in a place where the elevator was required to take them. Some feeling in my gut told me not to move, that soon you
would appear.
And you did appear. You looked around as if you were a guilty man, but as you entered the main lobby, you glanced at your reflection in the hotel mirror, and your face cracked open in a wide smile, as if you were amazed at what life was about to offer you. And I was also amazed, and in that moment, I knew exactly what was happening, and exactly what my place in it would be. I would tell no one, not even Leila. You slipped into the main hall and had returned to your seat by the time I got back, and you even had the audacity to say to me, "Where have you been? You're missing the wedding." You were a terrific liar, as well as a terrible one. Terrible in that no one believed you, and terrific because no one minded. You were charming and endearing, even as you deceived us. I let it happen. You were kids. It would pass, or you would change from it. For a while, you did change. In those years, we hardly spoke at all, but I observed the differences in your demeanor, and I was even secretly grateful. I grew fond of the girl when I saw her at mosque or at events. Let their feelings grow, I thought. I was confident you could win her affection. I hoped that she would be a presence that grounded you and gave you a future to focus on. And you did choose the classes in your community college that would go toward a pre-med course once you transferred. And I was pleased. "Please," Leila would tell me. "He's not made for these studies. They will waste his time and wear him out."
"I did not make him choose them," I said to her, annoyed.
"Maybe, but you have never encouraged him in any other endeavor. You have never let him think that any other path would be acceptable to you."
"That is enough."
She stepped back. I had yelled often, but never at her. I tried to reach out to touch her, but she turned from me. Eventually, when Leila came to me and said what was going on between you and the Ali girl, I did not tell her what I had seen years before, and how I had always assumed it. Leila was determined it would not be good for you, for our family. She was right, if all we considered was right and wrong. But I had found myself in a strange predicament. I had laid the foundation of our family on the principles of our faith and our customs. I had set standards for what we expected of each of you, hoping that you would rise to meet them. In our family, in the culture of our home, and indeed in the texture of our religion, there was the truth and there was the lie. There were sins, and there was a steadfast adherence to faith. But when Leila came to me, it was I, and not you, who was caught. I had created neat confines to help us move through the world, only to see you, my son, disregard them all. And I was finding I did not have the heart to uphold the very standards I myself had set. "You're right," I said to Leila, because she was. Of every grievance I hold against myself, there are two I have kept against your mother that, even now, I have never forgiven. The first is that she went to Seema Ali and told her. The second is that, when you returned for Hadia's wedding, she asked me to not go to you, fearing your return was fragile and conditional, and that had it not been for Hadia, you would want nothing to do with us. It was clear she blamed me for your departure, and I, also blaming myself, could not correct her or defend myself. I listened.
and by the time I went looking for you, it was too late.
Suno!
Leila calls behind me as I step out to the garden.
You should take your coat with you.
I continue on, pretending not to hear her. This is the benefit now of my age. I can ignore everything I do not wish to respond to. Point to my ear if I am later accused. Garden, trees, grass. Most days I move through the world automatically. On other days, I am snapped from the moment, and each blade of grass is its own individual blade. People pray their entire lives for things they will never receive. There are people, my friends even, who say, maybe there is no soul. Maybe there is no creator. My own son once said as much to me. But I have looked up at this sky since I was a child, and I have always been stirred in the most secret depth of me that I alone cannot access. And if that is not my soul awakening to the majesty of my Creator, then what is it?
You can't fool me. You are preparing to go. You are beginning to accept it.
It is Layla's voice behind me. I sigh. I turn to face her. She is holding on to my coat.
Be calm, Leila.
Rafiq, without you, I have nobody.
She looks around the garden as if nothing there pleases her. She lifts her arm and the coat sways.
I am here because you brought me here.
Everyone goes, Leila.
She nods. She presses her lips tight against each other.
Hadia told me why you went to her home. I find you in the kitchen or in your study mumbling to yourself. Speaking to who? Hadia says you are fine. The doctor said all tests are normal. But if something is wrong, will you tell me?
I say nothing. She is right. I have been in a dazed state.
Can you at least eat the food I make you? Drink the water I leave you? Can you remember your medicine? I am finding the pills folded in tissues on your desk.
I reach out my hand, and she hands me my coat. I slip into it.
Thank you,
she says, and she wipes at the edge of her eye with the side of her wrist, and turns around and walks back inside. She closes the sliding door behind her. She takes a seat at the kitchen table and does not know I am still watching. She rests her elbow on the table and covers her mouth with her hand. Who was I thinking of when I moved here? Only myself. I was a man, I thought, without roots. I was 13 when my father passed, 16 when my mother followed him. I was not raised so much as funded by my uncle. I was not touched tenderly by anyone all those years until I married Leila. I had no family when I came here and no money, and so I thought, nothing to lose. I was unable to get work in my field at first. I worked in a donut shop. I woke up at 4 a.m. to walk in darkness to get there before sunrise. I had a funny hat that folded, and I tucked it under my arm as I walked. I practiced my English. Every ancestor of mine was buried oceans and continents away. And though I could not grasp it then, as I walked to work in the middle of the night and making the decision to come here, I had drastically altered my destiny, and Leila's, and my children's, and also my grandchildren's. I brought them here, and one day I will leave them here. And what will the world be like when my Abbas and my Tahira are parents of their own children, and will they be welcome in it?
Leila, I say when I step back into the kitchen, I have not been myself. I know.
Thank you,
she says again.
But I am not planning on going anywhere yet.
She sniffles. Can I tell her?
It is becoming harder, I say, to not think of him.
I pick up an orange from the fruit bowl and run my thumb along its grooves. I wait for her to say something.
It is our test, she says. It will be hard.
I nod. I am meant to remain steadfast in my faith. Remain faithful. God does not take from the human what the human heart cannot bear. I return the orange to the bowl and prepare myself to step back outside. But I look up at Leila instead.
I do not want it to remain a test. I want to do something about it. I have to try.
4. When your mother shook me from sleep and told me about the small bruises that lined your arms, I was so disoriented I felt at first as though you were still a baby who had just begun to crawl, and she was asking out of casual concern and not looking to me, bewildered, to answer the questions she did not yet have the courage to ask. Why did I choose to look closely then? I waited until it was obvious, until everything that came before aligned with such striking clarity, it felt as if the darkness of the world was lit at once. The money that had gone missing from my wallet, you smelling strongly of booze, your eye so red, or else the dark of your eye a tiny speck, how you would not come home for days, how Leila would say you would be speaking to her and then, in the middle of conversation, fall asleep. Leila insisting her gold earrings were in the house somewhere, maybe sucked up by the vacuum cleaner. And when I went to check, she told me she had not liked them that much anyway.
I stepped into your bedroom.
You were sleeping so deeply. Your hand curled and tucked beneath your chin. Anything for this, I had prayed once, standing so still in the hospital hallway. Here you were, years later, fast asleep and breathing. I shook you, and still you did not wake. It smelled strongly of a body unwashed, a body that slept for hours. And something else I could not name. Vinegar, or the scent of an animal. I lifted your heavy arm from beneath your blanket and searched your skin until I found it. That black dot and the soft inside of your elbow, and another one. A bit below it, the bruise surrounding them both. And I heard your mother's voice from years ago, holding you, a baby in her arms, and pointing to the bruise on your thigh and saying, "This, how did this get here?" I looked through your belongings until I saw the irrefutable glint of light on the tip of the needle. And every excuse I had given myself before, it was not so bad, my son might sin now but would repent later, was rendered mute.
Well,
Leila said when I stepped out into the hallway,
what do you think is happening?
It occurred to me for the first time that we really had no clue.
I had never sipped alcohol in my life. When I first moved to America, I lived with 4 boys I hardly knew, and once
They had handed me a can they had just opened. I waited until they were talking with one another before going to the bathroom and pouring out the contents, yellow and fizzy and smelling quite horrible. And I said to God, I am sorry. Forgive me. I did not have the boldness to say no thank you. It was a story I thought I would tell you one day, and we could bond over a common response to the world. We were so very different. Now. In my own home. Now. My own son. What was unfathomable to me was possible to you. I told Layla to sleep. I told her I would be back, not to worry. I sat in my car. I did not know what to do. I called Hadia. She did not pick up. I panicked, not knowing what my children were capable of, having been made aware suddenly that the limit of their behavior was nothing my greatest fears could even conjure. We raised them here, hoping. Now it was out of our hands. They would do what they liked. Maybe it had always been out of our hands. Maybe anything we could have wanted to instill in them was, at best, a hope. I could not face your mother. I could not bear to pray in my own home, knowing Layla would be frightened that I was driven to kneel not out of obligation, but something else, something much more desperate and unfamiliar. Layla's faith came from her own heart. She would turn often to the text. She would weep listening to duas. She told you 3 stories of Imam Ali or Abraham as if she had been the one to come up with them. Amar, I know I must have struck you as a religious man, a man of faith. And I have fasted, and I have prayed, and I have gone to Mecca and Karbala, and I have worn black and bent my head in mourning every Muharram, and I have given money to the needy, and I have taught my children to stand when the Adhan is called. I believe sincerely that eating non-halal meat is a sin. Backbiting is a sin. Drinking is a sin. Not praying is a sin. And defying one's parents is a sin. But what I never told any of you, never even explored within myself, is that it has been a habit, my faith, a way of living I never questioned. And once you 3 were born, it was for you all that I adhered to it as I did. I wanted you 3 to grow with an awareness of God, with that order and compass and comfort it provided, safe from the dangers I could not imagine and could not protect you from. That night, I drove to the empty mosque. I had the keys from my efforts volunteering. It was dark, and it was quiet, and I was alone there. I could hear the beat of my own heart, and it sounded like an animal inside my chest. I stepped out of my shoes. I walked until I reached the large hall with the high ceilings, where vines and verses had been painted, elaborate calligraphy I sometimes stared up at while I listened to speeches. I took a seat where we gathered to stand in prayer, where you also stood beside me on some nights. I knelt. I rested my forehead against my cold hands, the way I had in the hospital room after you were born, and I only wanted to give thanks. And I thought, God, what do I do? What have I done? What is required of me as a father in this moment? My son has turned his back on you. He has learned nothing I wanted him to. He has followed nothing. He has descended in such a way that I am afraid not even you will forgive him. Why am I telling you this? I know you think I was only angry that night that I confronted you.
The day you were to run away, I had gone to the library to do my research. Hadia had surprised me in the early morning. I was so relieved to see her, I did not even scold her for driving all night. I hugged her very tight. I felt as though she was no longer just my daughter, but that she had also become my friend. I wanted to protect Layla, who would be devastated, but Hadia was wise and mature, and when I hugged her, I knew I could lean on her, trust her. I told her what I had found. She was silent.
"Have you known about this?" I asked.
"Not this."
She was very pale. I knew then I was not overreacting.
"What did you know about?"
She opened her mouth and then closed it, bit the bottom of her lip.
"Tell me," I said.
"I can't."
She crossed her arms.
"Hadia, now is not the time to protect him."
"You'll just get mad at him. Let me try to talk to him first, when he wakes up." I felt powerless. Everyone thought so little of me, I was beginning to wonder if they were all justified and I was the delusional one to think otherwise.
She made me swear I would not get mad, and I promised.
"Hadia,"
I called after her.
"I'm not angry. I'm not."
She stood in the hallway. She watched me. I deserved every unkindness they might accuse me of. But I was not mad at my son for this. I was too terrified to react in any way that was not the best way for you. I needed her to know that. Her eyebrows came together. She was either frustrated with me or felt sorry for me. I could not tell. In the library, I read article after article. I stayed away from the books. The pictures of the needles and spoons and bruised arms made me queasy. I rushed once to the bathroom and knelt on the tile floor by the toilet seat, thinking I was about to throw up, but I only breathed heavily. But this was very new behavior, I told myself. We had noticed just in time. I researched facilities that could help us. I even imagined that if you did not trust us, we could send you to live with Hadia. I could give up all hold over you, all expectations, just to keep you. I wrote a list titled Places. I did not want to think of it as rehab. The best ones closest to us. I called after a price. It would be a dent, one that made me sweat. Layla and I could sell the house earlier than we intended. I could keep working for a few extra years. Fine. It was all fine. It would all be well. That night, that last night, Hadia told me she would call her attending to say she would miss Monday and Tuesday. She would tell them she was having a family emergency. The word emergency made me again feel as I had in the library, like the world was spinning around me and I was going to be sick. I told her my idea. She did not agree with me right away, but she did not disagree either. I could tell she could not decide if I was a part of the problem or trying to solve it.
"You didn't knock," you said, when I went to your room.
I had knocked. I took a seat on your bed and watched you look for something. You raised your eyebrows. There was something harder about you. We had often disagreed, but now there was a layer of coldness, a shield you had formed against me. It was as if you were not there, or the part of you that was there was not affected by anything I could do or say.
I would be careful about this. I would not, as Hadia expected, get angry. I had spent my life getting angry at you, and look at where that had gotten us. Mama's making dinner, I tried, wanting to offer something neutral. I'm not hungry. You had your back to me. Amar, can you sit next to me? It was the last thing you expected. You paused your search, considered my invitation. You were still there, I thought. I could still reach you. You took a seat by me. I took out my paper. My hands shook. We do not have to talk about it. But we can send you here. It can help you stop.
Stop what?
You said. You glanced over the list. I did not want to say it. I found I could not. My mouth became dry. You shook your head as if I had insulted you and you jumped from the bed.
You went through my stuff,
you said, and screamed cuss words. It doesn't matter, I said, holding my hand out to you. I'm not angry. I want to help you. You kicked your desk chair and it fell over and crashed against the wall. You had begun yelling. Amar, I'm not angry with you. I said it again. You walked out into the hallway. I followed you. I stuffed my paper in my pocket. I stepped ahead and stood in front of you to block you from going downstairs. I reached out and put my hands on your shoulders.
You can't control me, you shouted. Amar, you can't do this. It is bad for your body, for your soul. It is haram. I don't care about haram or halal.
You had acted that way, but you had never said that before. I did not understand. One could be a bad Muslim, but one could not disregard so totally what was right and what was wrong.
How can you say that? You do not care if you go to hell?
I was yelling. I knew I was.
I don't believe in heaven or hell. I'm not a Muslim.
There it was. Of all the things I thought might be possible when I stood in the hallway of the hospital and watched you, wrapped in a blanket, of all you might do or become, this had not even occurred to me. It was the farthest outcome from my mind, the most chilling of verses. We will send them signs and they will still deny, had become my own son. Amar, I know what I said next. You know what I said. And we both know what followed. You stood there as in shock as I was. Your eyes were wide. You looked so afraid. It's okay. I had the impulse to reach out and tell you then. It's okay. It will be okay, I promise you. These things happen. You went to your room. I went to mine. Hadia looked at me like she despised me. And Leila did not speak to me. It would be another 40 days before she spoke to me again, and even longer before she could look me in the eye. She fell asleep at the farthest edge of the bed, and I lay awake, blinking at the dark ceiling. I had done a terrible thing. I had disowned my child. I had been shocked by your words, and out of cruelty, I threw back my own. The worst I could muster. I never asked you to leave, I know that now. I remember that much. I lay awake wondering if I should go to you. You were not Muslim. The thought pained me greatly then and for years after, and even sometimes now. But there was no compulsion in Islam. I took comfort in the verses that expressed it. Everyone has free will. In time, I knew we could work our way around it. I could become accustomed. Even on that night, I told myself, there was nothing the human heart could not grow to endure. That the miracle of the human heart is that it expands in its capacity to accept, to love. I used the wrong words, Amar. Or I should never have spoken them at all. But I have only ever thought of you as my son. My only. I decided that in the morning, when things had cooled, I would go to you again. I would try again not to be angry. I would say to you, if you are not Muslim, fine, I accept. But I am still your father. You cannot get rid of me. You might not care if you sin, and that is fine, too. But I am concerned for your body. But by morning you were gone, Hadia, fast asleep in your place. Hadia has come to our home to ask if we will watch the kids for her and Tariq next week. It is their 9-year anniversary. Of course, we say. As soon as we have answered, I make an excuse to leave the house, to go and check the mail. Outside, alone in the driveway, I think of how long it has been since we last saw you. The door opens and Hadia steps out. The magnolia tree is in full bloom, and Hadia admires the petals, wide open as they are. I wonder what she is thinking when she says, "Mama says you're having a hard time." I am fine, so I say nothing. I pretend to study the envelopes in my hand. Hadia takes a seat at the edge of the driveway and then looks up at me and says, "I know you hate when I do this, but join me." She is right. It always bothered me. It would make the neighbors wonder why we were acting strange. Still, I take a seat. When I was younger and mad at you, I would sit out here and wish for a life where I could just step out. Did your wish come true? Everything I ever wanted has become mine. It is a blessed sentence, but she has spoken it sadly, picks up a pebble and pinches it between her fingers. "And are you still mad at me?" I ask her. I look at my hands and clasp them together. Hadia does not say no, but from the corner of my eye, I see her shake her head. In the months since the surgery, I have repaid all debts I owed. I have drafted a will and dated it. "I remember asking you about Amar," I tell her. She sighs. "I wish I had some information I could give you," she says.
"You don't know where he is, then?"
She shakes her head.
"Do you think it's my fault he ran away?"
I ask.
The sky is so vast and clear. I look up to no sun and still squint.
"There is no way for us to know that. I've thought about it for years, and every time I do, there is a new cause to consider. Do you think it was your fault?"
I nod. "I told him he wasn't my son.
Baba, we said all kinds of things, even he did. I think Amar convinced himself he did not belong, and he was waiting for any reason to go.
I talked to him at your wedding. I was the last one who did. She looks at me then with a look that says, please do not tell me if it will change things between us. I haven't even told your mother that.
What did you say?
Hadia whispers. Every single day, I have tried to remember that conversation. There was so much happening that night, and so little stayed here. I point to my head. He was upset. He had been drinking heavily. I could smell it. His words were slippery.
Hadia's eyes fill.
I place a hand on her shoulder. She leans into me and rests her head against my arm. I told him that inshallah, it would be all right one day. I didn't say to him, never come home again. I didn't say that.
I believe you.
Behind us, the leaves of the magnolia tree rustle.
I lied,
she says. I hold my breath at once.
I have known there was more. My heart leaps. I am so afraid she will speak, and it will not be enough. A few years ago, when Abbas was about 5, I came downstairs after putting Tahira down for a nap, and Abbas was on the phone, just talking and talking. I took the phone from him. The person hung up as soon as I spoke. Who was that? I asked Abbas. He wouldn't tell me. No one, he said. Okay, I asked him. What did you talk to him about? Abbas didn't correct me, didn't say it was a she. About me, he said, and about Tahira. I knew it was Amar. How could it have been anyone else? He just asked questions, Abbas said. What kind of questions? I asked. Can you try to remember for Mama? How old Tahira is, he said. What you are like with us? What you do with us? If you are a good mummy? What did you say? I asked. He said yes. I was a nice mummy. That sometimes I took them to the park. He could tell I was trying not to cry. Please tell me, I said to him. You're not in trouble. I promise. Just try to remember everything you can for Mama. He eased a little. He asked a lot about Nana and Nani, he said. He wanted me to talk about them. Anything specific? I asked. No, he said. I told him what food they make and about Nana's gift drawer, what Nani likes to do and Nani's flowers. What did he say? I asked when you told him all of this. He said, keep going.
I do not know what to say. I turn my face away from Hadia, unable to look at her. Hadia sits up straight and continues.
There are times, every year or so, when the phone rings from a blocked number and I answer and say hello. Hello? Salam? Then I say, is it you? And the caller hangs up. After that first time, I noticed Abbas would perk up when the phone rang, and he would look at me when it did. Just a few months ago, Tariq also came upon Abbas on the phone while I was at work. When Abbas saw Tariq, he hung up immediately. Tariq asked, who was that, Abbas? And Abbas just gave Tariq that look of his when he lies and said, I don't know.
For your 6th birthday, your mother baked a cake
and tried to make blue frosting